Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 344. Pearl Harbor meets the Reichstag, part one. This is no drill, this is a real attack. This is being recorded on January 20th of the year 2002. In For the Record 344, we're analyzing the military and foreign policy aspects of the September 11th, 2001 terrorist blitzkrieg. In number 345, we're going to be examining some of the domestic political implications, and again, the distinctions between foreign and domestic, political, military, and economic are to a certain extent conceptual and for the purposes of time. Now, continuing with our analysis of Islamism or Islamofascism as a political stratagem to be used by Third Reich and Underground Reich geopoliticians in order to gain control of the Middle East, petroleum reserves, and the Earth Island, we're going to continue with a book that we've used in the last broadcast and in the first half of this broadcast. That book is called Dollars for Terror, by Richard LaBeviere. This book is a remarkable analysis of various aspects of the political equation of 2001, and we're going to go right to discussion here of an Islamist and French political scientist named François Bourgat, or Bourgat. Now, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, B-U-R-G-A-T. Turning to Dollars for Terror by Richard LaBeviere, we read, François Bourgat, a researcher at the CNRS and a political scientist, author of L'Islamisme en face, or roughly, Islamism as confrontation, is an ardent defender of this apology for a communautarianisme à la française, unquote. We should stop for a moment and even quote this publication several times over, not so much to answer the author word for word, but to spell out the opposition that underlies our whole investigation, the emergence of a theocratic ideology opposing secularity. This attack against the founding principles of the Republic is particularly alarming, given that it is carried out by propagandists who advance undercover and take advantage of our guilty conscience with regard to the Third World. In France, this is particularly the case since the end of the Algerian War. Skipping down. While it is not very common to see a researcher step through the mirror to the other side this way, it is rarer still to observe a scientist express such messianic certainty. His title states the thesis, implying an Islamism that blocks the horizon and sets its own rules for an inescapable dialogue, an obligation to make things clear, a requirement that cannot be evaded. Islamism, according to Bourgat, continues the labor of an unfinished decolonization. Ultimately, it is a new type of liberation movement founded on the claim of cultural identity, unquote. It is an old saw to say that religious fanaticism thus justifies its excesses through identity and, quote, the right to be different, unquote. Skipping down. He seems to be describing the Islamist trajectory as a return to a sort of paradise lost, pre-colonial, primordial, if not ahistorical. And in that context, and also in the context of the geopolitics of Karl Haushofer, about whom we've spoken in past broadcasts, consider the following. Now, for an understanding of not only third-position fascism, but the geopolitics of Karl Haushofer, and also François Genoux and some of the political dynamics that we're speaking about in this broadcast, I want to refer listeners to the encyclopedic Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey in the Post-War or Fascist International. That book was authored by Kevin Coogan, published in soft cover by Otano Media Incorporated. And by the way, the book was edited by on-air personality Dave Mandel from sister station WFMU-FM. In For the Record program number 340 and in broadcast 343, we talked about Karl Haushofer, the German geopolitician, whose thinking affected, to a certain extent, Adolf Hitler and beyond that, some of the geopolitical thinkers of the Third Reich in both its above-ground and post-war underground incarnations. What we're going to be looking at here is a review of some of the theories and affiliations of Ahmed Huber, Now, Ahmed Huber is an associate of the German National Democratic Party, the most important German, quote, neo-unquote Nazi party. In turn, a member of the board of directors of NADA Management, formerly Altaqua, and an individual that we've spoken about in, for the record, 335, 336, 338, 340, 341, 342, and 343. Of Ahmed Huber, La Baviere writes, a member of the group Avalon, which claims to be based on the, quote, great Celtic tradition, unquote, at every solstice he meets under the moon amidst great trees with a few hundred European druids with whom he is preparing the, quote, end of our decline, unquote. With the group Thule, a secret society particularly popular in the German administration and the political class, he works for the restoration of, quote, greater Germany, unquote. The Thule Group's ties with Islam go back many years, in particular through the theories of Haushofer, Horbiger, and René Guénon. In the wake of the Annenerbe, the Nazi Society for Esoteric Studies, and parenthetically a subdivision of the SS, bonds were woven between Islam and the neo-Nazi far right. With the French hard-right Club de l'Horloge, the bank's shareholder strives to make contact with, quote, all true European and American nationalists, unquote. Recently, he went to Chicago for a discreet congress that brought together the, quote, authentic right and the fighters for Islam, unquote. And he says that, quote, major decisions were taken. The reunification is underway, unquote. During his many tribulations, Ahmed Huber became acquainted with neo-Nazi banker François Genoux, whose path in life presents a singular summary of the interconnections, the specific alliances that have been tied and untied between Islam and the swastika. Still referring to the neo-Nazi banker, Huber told Pierre Payen, quote, I never asked him any questions, but I noted that in circles as different as the German right, the Islamic movements of Asia, the Palestinians, and in the Maghreb, people speak of him with great respect. Everyone told me he helped us. I have the impression that he played an important, though discreet, role. It was I who introduced him to the Iranians. And as noted in part one of this broadcast, it is my opinion and working hypothesis here that what I call the underground right constitutes the element cementing of previously disparate elements such as the Christian far right and European fascist and neo-Nazi elements, elements within the Islamic community such as the sharply and often lethally divided Shiite and Sunni Muslims, and also the previously sharply divided and often lethally divided secular Arabist movements such as the Palestinian Liberation Organization and also the Ba'ath parties of Iraq and Syria. And I am of the opinion that it is the underground Reich and Islamofascism that are uniting these. Now, of Jacques Vergès, the formerly far-left and now third-position fascist attorney, although he would deny being a fascist, Vergès is someone who in the past has represented Carlos the Jackal and also SS war criminal Klaus Barbie, about whom we've spoken many times in the past. Barbie discussed in many programs, including RFA 19, RFA 2, and in some of our previous broadcasts dealing with François Genoux and Jacques Vergès. I would note that we spoke about Genoux at considerable length in For the Record 333. We came back to Genoux and his sponsorship of Carlos the Jackal, in particular after Carlos was arrested in Sudan in 1994, in For the Record program number 341. We returned to Genoux in 343. Now, of the association between François Genoux, in turn, an association between an associate of Ahmed Huber, of the association between Genoux and Vergès, and bear in mind Huber's connection here, we read, turning to Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaki and the Post-War Fascist International, in the early 1980s, Genoux and Vergès returned to center stage. On February 16, 1982, Genoux's friend Bruno Breguet and a German woman named Magdalena Kopp were arrested in Paris after police discovered guns, hand grenades, and 4 kilos of explosives in their car. cop, it turned out, was a member of the German revolutionary cells created by Johannes Weinrich. She was also Carlos's common-law wife. Vergès took charge of their legal defense while Genoux paid the bills. Meanwhile, Carlos began writing threatening letters to French Interior Minister Gaston Defferre, while a series of bombs went off in different parts of the country. The Cop Breguet trial proved to be a warm-up for another even more spectacular Genoux and Vergès operation, the legal defense of Klaus Barbie, a Nazi war criminal who had been extradited from Bolivia to France in 1982. While engaged in his Arab adventures, Genoux continued to maintain excellent relations with top Nazis like General de Grelle, General Wolf, and General Reimer. He was also close to New European Order founder Guy Amadruz, who ran the NEO's main branch out of Lausanne, which happened to be Genoux's hometown. Asked his opinion of Amadruz, Genoux said that his, quote, "grand vertu, il est extrêmement fidèle courageux, c'est un saint." Genoux and Vergès used Barbie's trial to condemn France for its crimes against Algeria. Although Barbie was easily convicted, many questions about him remained. During his time in Bolivia, Barbie regularly fed the CIA information on the left throughout Latin America using a contact in Bolivia's interior ministry. Yet Barbie and Hans Ulrich Rudel, his partner in the weapons business, were believed to have had Cuban ties as well. Barbie was also reportedly involved in supplying weapons to the Italian ultra-leftist millionaire Gian Giacomo Feltrinelli. It remains an open question whether Genoux helped Barbie simply out of abstract principle, or because he himself had been a player in Barbie's arms and intelligence operation. I would note that Barbie was also allegedly involved in Operation Condor. We discussed that in For the Record 284. Continuing of Genoux, Genoux became directly involved in helping Carlos after the Jackal was arrested in the Sudan by French agents on August 15, 1994. For some years after Wadi Haddad's death, Carlos operated out of bases in Hungary and other Eastern European countries. He also spent time in Damascus. After Carlos's arrest, Genoux publicly expressed his great admiration for him. Genoux considered Carlos one of the heroes of the Palestinian cause. Now, that is by way of review. What is quite interesting here is the fact that the attorney who was representing Carlos the Jackal and who is now going to marry Carlos the Jackal is also representing Zacharias Moussaoui. He has been charged with complicity with Al-Qaeda and is going to be standing trial in the United States. Now, again, his attorney is a woman named Isabelle Coutant-Pale, and her profile is discussed in the New York Times of Saturday, January 12th of 2002. This is an article by Suzanne Daly. It's headlined, "Bucking the Court Again to Marry the Jackal." It's Dateline Paris, January 11th. And bear in mind the connection here between François Genoux and Carlos the Jackal, between François Genoux and Ahmed Huber, the connection here between François Genoux, Klaus Barbie, and Jacques Vergès. At first, Mrs. Coutant-Pere specialized in bankruptcy law, but in 1981, she was taken under the wing of Jacques Vergès, a legendary defender of celebrity villains. That would place Isabelle Coutant-Pere, who's going to be representing Zacharias Moussaoui and who's going to be marrying Carlos the Jackal, directly under the wing, as indicated there, of Jacques Vergès, the Genoux protégé. Now, in discussing Ahmed Huber, we saw a reference to Karl Haushofer, one of the top Nazi geopoliticians. Now, in understanding the fascist third position, and one of the things that we spoke about in For the Record 340, Haushofer's view of the Islamist movement and the, quote, colored world, unquote, as a means of establishing what Ahmed Huber referred to as Greater Germany, one should consider one of the principal elements in geopolitical theory, the concept of the Earth Island. Now, what Haushofer called the Earth Island is the giant landmass that would begin in the west with Spain in the Straits of Gibraltar, that would include all of continental Europe, including Scandinavia, the former Soviet Union, Central Europe, most of Eurasia, including parts of the Middle East, all the way through India and China. That obviously comprises most of the Earth's landmass. It also, not incidentally, includes most of the world's petroleum reserves. And looking across the middle, if one envisions the Earth Island from a map or a globe, right across the middle of it stretches a huge block of Muslim population, constituting the vast bulk of the world's 1.5 billion Muslims. It was to gain control of the Earth Island by utilizing the Muslim population of the world that Haushofer sought just such an alliance between the Third Reich and fascism and the Islamic world. And in addition to gaining control of the Earth Island, one would thereby gain control of most of the world's petroleum reserves and effect world domination. Now, turning to, once again, the concept of Al-Qaeda as Africa Corps II, so to speak, or as the realization of the fascist third position Haushofer tactic of utilizing the third world, the Muslim world, the colored world, as it was referred to by Hitler associate Haushofer, and the very milieu that was being actively promoted by people like Janu, Vergès, perhaps Isabelle Peyre, and also, obviously, by Ahmed Huber. We're going to turn once again to Dollars for Terror by Richard Labeyrière, and we're going to take a look at his analysis of the raison d'etre for the attack on the U.S. embassies of August 7th, 1998. It was those attacks that precipitated a retaliation by cruise missiles by President Clinton on, among other installations, the Al-Shifa pharmaceutical plant that in turn generated outrage not only in the Third World but criticism on the part of the American left, this at a time when Bill Clinton was facing impeachment. Turning to Dollars for Terror, the United States did not wait long to respond to the August 7th, 1998 attacks against the American embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. On August 20th, cruise missiles hit several military camps in Afghanistan and an industrial plant in Sudan. During a short televised speech, President Clinton gave the official reasons for the action. An urgent investigation apparently had established Osama bin Laden's direct responsibility. During the attack, American interceptors violated Pakistani airspace. Classified top secret, unquote, the actual results of the bombing were disappointing. Not only was the anti-terrorist objective not achieved, but the Sudanese target, a pharmaceutical factory, causes a worldwide furor. Was it or was it not part of bin Laden's military apparatus? The answer to this question and the explanation for the attacks in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam are related to the Sudanese political imbroglio. The religious guide of the Islamist regime of Khartoum, Hassan el-Turabi, who had been seeking a rapprochement with the United States, was attracting lightning bolts from the regime's hawks. It was to thwart his initiatives that they, with the assistance of bin Laden, had financed and organized the two attacks of August 7th. FBI investigations revealed several connections between the CIA and the Saudi billionaires' networks. Bin Laden Gate was underway. Causing a wave of protest in the Arab world, the American response only confirmed Islamism in its distrust toward the West. And turning to one of the people allegedly involved with the attack on the pharmaceutical plant, and as we looked at in For the Record 342, there are substantive indications that bin Laden was in fact connected to the Al-Shifa, pharmaceutical factory, and that in fact it may have been involved in the production of binary chemical weapons. However, the ownership of that factory was to a certain extent deliberately obscured, and LaBeuvière maintains that the attack on that factory was deliberately precipitated with an attack on American diplomatic installations in order to frustrate the attempted rapprochement between the Sudanese government and the United States, thereby further outraging the Islamic world against the United States and helping to attenuate, or at least hopefully, in their view, attenuate American involvement in that part of the world. We're going to talk about the domestic American implications next week. Of the attack on the embassies and a very interesting unnamed player in that attack, the manager of the Hotel Heron Court, a five-star establishment, was suspected of having rendered logistical assistance to the commando. This individual of German extraction left Kenya the day before the August 7th attack. That perhaps suggests Borman involvement. What we're going to look at now concerns the agreement that was established in 1929 between Standard Oil of New Jersey and the Nazi IG Farben chemical plant that was a key element of the Third Reich and also a key element of the Borman Organization. What we're going to listen to is an excerpt from Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, recorded on May 23rd, 1980.
Perhaps the single most important contribution that an American firm made to the Nazi war effort was the technology transfer effected from Standard Oil of New Jersey to the giant German chemical cartel of IG Farben. There are three areas that we're going to focus on in our discussion. The first concerned Standard IG cooperation with regard to the hydrogenation process, through which oil is derived or synthesized from coal. The second concerns the transfer of isooctane and tetraethyl lead technology to the Nazis. And the third concerns the transfer of butyl rubber technology to the Nazis. Each of these was essential for the prosecution of modern warfare.
We'll explain just how essential.
Beginning with the hydrogenation process, it's important to note that the Blitzkrieg, Hitler's motorized columns and closely integrated Air Force units, obviously demanded a lot of fuel. Germany has no domestic oil reserves to speak of, and as such, the prosecution of modern war by Germany was dependent on the synthesizing of fuels. The hydrogenation process, by which oil is synthesized from coal, Germany has very plentiful coal reserves, was developed through cooperation between Standard Oil and IG Farben in the 1926 through 29 period. In 1929, Standard and IG formed the so-called Standard IG Agreement, which provided for the formation of the Standard IG Company. This was a research company which was owned 80% by Standard Oil and 20% by IG. Now, what they each got from this agreement that was important was the following. Standard was afraid that eventually IG's synthetic oil might threaten their worldwide preeminence in the oil market, so they sought to eliminate IG as a world competitor. They did not want to have to compete with IG synthetic oil. IG, by the same token, had sunk so much capital into the development of the hydrogenation process that they were actually threatened by the amount of the investment. If they were not able to obtain capital, it is quite probable that IG as a company might have had to dissolve, and this would have been absolutely fatal for Hitler's war-making effort. So what Standard obtained from IG was an agreement, that Standard would have the rights for the worldwide marketing of oil synthesized under the hydrogenation process, except in Germany, so that IG was still in the position to develop, to manufacture, and market synthetic oil in Germany. This, however, served Standard's purpose of eliminating IG and their synthetic oil as a competitor. In return, IG not only retained the rights to manufacture synthetic oil for Germany, but more importantly, they received 2% of Standard Oil's stock. That was a total of $35 million, and this piece of capital was absolutely essential for the continued functioning of IG Farben. Without that capital, it's quite possible that IG Farben would have dissolved. Had IG Farben dissolved, the Third Reich would have dissolved and World War II would not have happened.
That again from Uncle Sam and the Swastika, Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, recorded on May 23rd of 1980. I would also note that the synthetic oil production of IG Farben was absolutely central to the German war-making effort in World War II, and their Leuna facility was ultimately restored by the Soviet Union and was the focal point of maneuvering after the reunification of Germany that was at the center of the CDU funding scandal and the underground Reich's maneuverings, as analyzed in For the Record 194, 276, and 278. And of the Bormann Organization's subsequent involvement with Standard Oil of New Jersey through the Bormann Organization, turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, authored by Paul Manning, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981, we read of the Bormann Organization, IG Farben, and Standard Oil. The Bormann Organization continues to wield enormous economic influence. Wealth continues to flow into the treasuries of its corporate entities in South America, the United States, and Europe. Vastly diversified, it is said to be the largest landowner in South America, and through stock holdings controls the German heavy industry and the trust established by the late Hermann Schmitz, former president of IG Farben, who held as much stock in Standard Oil of New Jersey as did the Rockefellers. And noting also, turning back to Dollars for Terror, an alleged connection between Saudi finance and the Bormann Organization, although it's not mentioned by name. And For the Record 305, we took a look at the Nazi gold and its presence in Swiss bank accounts, and that imbroglio's connections to the Bormann Organization. Turning to Dollars for Terror again, we read, the affair of the Nazi gold and the fact that Swiss banks have recently been obliged to return funds to several Jewish associations have encouraged Gulf financiers to prefer the Swiss money market, according to several financial experts who confirm that Saudi capital plays a central role in Swiss banking circles. The publication of a confidential report from the Foreign Office on September 10, 1996, relating to the deposits of Nazi gold in Switzerland, estimated at the end of the war to be between $200 and $500 million, set off the powder keg and launched the affair known as the Jewish Funds. Switzerland took on the commitment to restore several billion dollars to the World Jewish Congress. Quote, in return, this event has caused a sympathetic reaction among certain Arab financial milieu, especially Saudi, for the Swiss money market, unquote, the banker adds. And anticipating an element we're going to talk about in For the Record 345, the effect on the American political and economic landscape of Saudi investment or petrodollars, we're going to turn to The American House of Saud, The Secret Petrodollar Connection by Stephen Emerson, published in hardcover by Franklin Watts, copyright 1985. And of Saudi investment in the United States and its investment on the United States, ironically, the willingness of American corporations and executives to do the bidding of Arab governments constitutes a reversal of the traditional, if unethical, role of multinational corporations. For years, American and other multinationals have broken international laws or have interfered in the affairs and policies of foreign governments, skipping down. Petrodollar trade, however, has created a reverse imperialism. Instead of trying to advance American interests, unquote, abroad, American corporations here become the pawns of Arab nations in trying to change American policies. That concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 344, Pearl Harbor meets the Reichstag fire. This is no drill, this is a real attack, being recorded on January 20th of the year 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.